Yeah, so let me echo Liz's words of welcome, and thank you all for coming out tonight. I think this is going to be one of the very best things we do all year. On this day, 100 years ago, not far from here, less than 25 miles away, Jackie Robinson was born in a sharecropper's home outside of Cairo, Georgia. Robinson lived there for only a year. His parents split up, and his mother and the older siblings and Jackie moved to Pasadena, California, where he spent most of his childhood. At the end of his high school days, Jackie made the single biggest mistake of his entire life and went to the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA, instead of doing what he should have done, which is to go to USC and play for the Trojans. I'm the father of two Trojans, I'm sorry. Okay. At UCLA, get this, he lettered in four different sports: football, basketball, track, and baseball. And baseball arguably was his weakest sport. So he was a multi-sport athlete who distinguished himself greatly in more than just baseball. But around this same time, one of Jackie's older siblings, his brother Mac, was making a name for himself. And that's where, in many ways, our story tonight is going to pick up. I'm joined here on the panel by Fred Flowers, who many of you know. Fred's a longtime Tallahasseean who basically was the Jackie Robinson of Florida State University, and we are delighted to have him with us tonight. To his right is Dr. Linda Walden. Linda is a cousin of Mac and Jackie Robinson, and get this, she is also a cousin of Fred Flowers. So I don't think there's anyone in America that can make that same claim to be both a cousin of Jackie and of the Jackie Robinson of FSU. But we are delighted to have Linda here. She's a medical doctor, had a family practice in Cairo, also lives now in Southwest Georgia and continues to do practice medicine there. And then at the far end is my friend Bob Sanchez. Many of you know Bob has a distinguished career in journalism, is a Pulitzer Prize winner, who got his start writing for the Florida Flambeau back in the early 1960s. He went on to teach at Florida A&M, had also taught at Florida High, and has followed this story and others like it much of his life. He writes columns about all sorts of things, has expertise in Florida history and other things beyond just sports. But he's a baseball lover like I am and was a perfect person to complete our panel. So please join me in welcoming all of these distinguished panelists. All right, so Linda, I want to start with you and just say, tell us a little bit more about Mac. I know we're here to celebrate Jackie, and we'll do a lot of that. But Mac's story is one that is often overlooked and not known. So tell us a little bit more about Mac and about your family.
Most certainly. It's a great pleasure to be here, first of all, to be with you on this special grand day as we recognize an American hero, and not only just Jackie, but Mac as well. Mac was Jackie's older brother. He was only 5 years older than Jackie. He was the knee baby in the family. And Mac also was not just a cousin. He was my uncle. He married my mother's sister later on in life, and so he became my uncle. And I got to know him and know more about Jackie through my Uncle Mac. And one thing that people don't realize, Jackie was a phenomenal athlete, but so was Uncle Mac as well. He participated in the 1936 Berlin Olympics with Jesse Owens. And it was my Uncle Mac that beat Jesse Owens in all the preliminaries before the Olympics. And really, seriously, and when he won the silver medal, he and Jesse won the gold medal, he won the silver medal, and he won it. Jesse beat him just by a few milliseconds. And if you ever go to the records, it'll tell you it was just a few milliseconds how he beat him. And my Uncle Mac often said if he had been able to afford better shoes, he would have beat him because he had worn his shoes out. And, you know, back in 1936 when the Berlin Olympics took place, you know, we didn't have sponsors like they do now to sponsor all these athletes with the best of everything, you know. And so Uncle Mac won the silver medal, and I remember him telling me the story when he and Jesse received their medal. You know, Hitler was the one that was supposed to present those medals. Well, Hitler hated Jews and he hated blacks. And he walked off the stage when the two of them won. And it was the next person in command who handed them their medals. And Uncle Mac, you know, he came back after representing the United States of America, and this was in 1936, just to show you how things were. You would expect someone who won a medal like that, he and Jesse, for the United States, that he would have come back to a grand affair of people really cheering him on. And he often said when he got off the train in Pasadena, there was no one there but his mother, his siblings, and that was it. That was it. There was no big fanfare.
Now, a minute ago, when you mentioned your mother, you gestured, and lo and behold, you have other members of your family here.
Yes.
How about taking a second and just recognizing them, if you would?
Yes, I have my mother, Lula Hatley Walden, and Uncle Mac married her sister, Jesse's brother. And she often, we lived in New York, where I was born, in Queens, New York, and where Jackie and Rachel lived in St. Albans, and that's where we moved, to St. Albans. In fact, most of the family members that migrated from Georgia that went to New York lived in that same area. And so I wasn't born at the time when Jackie played from 1947 to 1957. It was right after that that I was born, but my mom and dad would often go see him play. And she would often tell me stories about how things were and how the people reacted and treated Jackie, which if you want me to get into, we can get into later.
Yeah, we will as we go. You grew up, though, it's important to recognize, in New York, but then eventually made her way to Southwest Georgia, where she lives now, and where Linda has been very instrumental in seeing the birthplace of Jackie Robinson and other key points of interest around Cairo recognized and commemorated. So we are in debt to you for preserving that, getting it on the historic registry, getting Jackie Robinson Memorial Highway named, and other things of that nature.
Yeah, well, I actually finished school. I went to grade school in Sebring, Florida. And in Sebring, Florida, I was the first of three to integrate those schools back in those days, myself. And where is the gentleman here who was from Sebring? But anyway, yes, Mr. Mason. He was in my classmate. There was three of us, and the two Saffold children were. We were the first three to integrate in that Highlands County.
So this is just a family of pioneers breaking barriers everywhere they go.
Yes.
All right, but Fred, you want to remind us that even before Jackie and Mac, there were other athletes, African-American athletes, that were gaining prominence. And tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, Bill. Do I have?
Yeah, there you go. That was working.
It works?
Yeah. There we go.
Bill told me I should stay seated when I talk. You see, I'm not following instructions very well. But there's so much that I would like to say. First of all, I want to thank Bill and Billy Square for putting this on. I stand before you today as a member of the Florida State University Civil Rights Institute, and I see some of our members present. Can I acknowledge them?
Please, yes.
The interim director, Bridget Birmingham. Committee member, Dr. Patrick Mason.
All right.
My great friend, attorney Terry Coonan. Did I miss anybody? Okay. Just a little digression about the creation of the Florida State University Civil Rights Institute. Much credit goes to this man, in a way.
Let's save that for later.
Okay, all right.
Tell us about black athletes before Jackie Robinson.
Okay. That's a big subject. And I can't limit it to 90 seconds. All right. And also, I need to acknowledge the presence of my wife, Loretta. Don't want to make that mistake. But in order to understand the role of the black athlete in America and in Jackie Robinson, you can't start with Jackie Robinson. You got to go back 100 years. That would take us to 1847. Let's go back another 100 years. That would take you to 1747. Let's go back another 100. That'll take you to the year 1647, which is the origin of the agricultural economy and the slave industry in America. So you have to go back to the gains of the slave plantation to understand the role of the black athlete in America. So what do I mean by that? During slavery, gains were an important part of the survival of the slaves. So there were all sorts of gains: horse races, foot races, strongman contests, boxing, and wrestlers. So during the 300 years during the slavery, an institution of slavery, you had the rise of certain premier athletes on the slave plantation. So just use your imagination with me. You can imagine the master of the plantation in Cairo calling the master of a plantation in Albany saying, "My bucks are faster than your bucks." "No, they're not. Let's have a contest." And so wagering on the slave contest was a big business among the slave owners. But the money didn't accrue to the people who performed. It accrued to the slave owners. So the importance of understanding slavery connects to the rise of the first wave of great black athletes. And as I look at this horse, that's right on point, because the first great wave of black athletes was the black jockey. The year 1875 was a great year in American history for the creation of the passage of the Civil Rights Act, which gave newly created rights to the former slaves. But in 1875, that was the first running of the Kentucky Derby. There were 15 riders. 13 of them were black, including the winner, Oliver Wendell, I believe. So from 1800s to the 1900s, the black jockey were the highest paid, the most celebrated athletes in America. That's very significant now because they disappeared. That's very instructive to what might happen today. That happened in golf. At one time, the black caddy was the dominant force. They disappeared. So when you talk about Jackie Robinson, you got to go back to the beginning. In 1901, the greatest cyclist in the world was a black man named Major Thompson. He dominated the world of cycling internationally from 1900 to 1901. So now we're coming up to the role of Jackie Robinson. I'm trying to place him in the proper historical perspective from which he came. So I'm wearing a hat now, the Negro League. And with me also wearing that hat is a great baseball player named Alfred Washington, who's also wearing the Negro League hat. But I'm going to try to respond directly to one of your questions about American Legion ball.
Let's save that. Here's what we're going to do, just for all of you to kind of help us follow. We're going to spend the first part of our time looking at Jackie Robinson's life and his baseball career. Spend some time then looking at Fred Flowers and the lives and careers of many of those who followed after Jackie. And then we'll spend some time reflecting on what we can learn from these athletes and where we stand kind of today. We'll have opportunity for each of you, if you'd like, to ask questions. But I want to stop where you are and pull Bob into the conversation and ask this, Bob. Okay, so we know of Joe Louis and other great black athletes, Mac and Jesse Owens and others, that distinguished themselves, that got attention, as well as some that, whose stories are not well known and that Fred was reminding us of. Help us then understand why Jackie Robinson's breaking of the baseball color barrier in 1947 was so significant. If there were all these other athletes before him, what was the big deal?
Well, my mic on?
Yes.
Okay. Until on up through the 40s, baseball really was the nation's national pastime in many respects. Boxing, horse racing, and baseball were much bigger than pro football or even college football, which was pretty much centered with the Ivy Leagues and Notre Dame and the service academies. So this was before the age of TV also. In 1947, the year Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues, there were only 44,000 TV sets in the whole United States, and there were only six TV stations on the air in 1946, the year before he broke the color line. Three in New York City, one in Chicago, one in Philadelphia, and one in Schenectady, New York, because that's where GE was. So radio was very important. The sport of baseball was very important. It filled a lot of time on radio. So that's one reason it was so significant. This was just the year after President Truman desegregated the armed forces. Jackie Robinson had fought during World War II in segregated outfits and came home to a still segregated country. And luckily, President Truman had the courage to desegregate the armed forces. But the context of what happened in 1947 is that the country was very different than from what it is now. And in the array of sports, baseball was still king.
So baseball is king. It's the national pastime. It's the game most followed by most people. And lo and behold, it allows an African-American for the first time in the 20th century to enter the ranks and to play. So Jackie, as you mentioned, had served in the military during that time between UCLA and his entry. He spent a year in the Negro Leagues playing for the Kansas City Monarchs. And then he gets signed by Branch Rickey. And by the way, while he was in the military, Martin Luther King would later say of Jackie that he was a sit-inner before there were sit-ins, that he was a freedom rider before there were freedom rides. And guess what? He was, in a certain sense, Rosa Parks before there was Rosa Parks, because while he was in the military, he at one point was instructed to go to the back of a bus that he was traveling in a city, and refused to do so, and got himself in a little bit of trouble, much like Rosa did, ends up being discharged from the military, and goes on to play ball for the Kansas City Monarchs, gets the attention of Branch Rickey, the owner of the Brooklyn Dodgers, and Rickey takes him and says, I want to sign you to, Robinson thinks that the meeting has been scheduled because there was rumors that Branch Rickey is going to start a Negro League team. But instead, Branch Rickey says, no, I want you to come play for the Brooklyn Dodgers. And so the question I have for you, Linda, is why does Branch Rickey, of all the possible players that he could have chosen, why does he pick Jackie Robinson? What was it about Jackie that caused Rickey to say, this is the guy that I want to make this historic change?
Well, first of all, as you mentioned earlier, Jackie played for the Kansas City Monarchs, the Negro League. And he had scouts. Branch Rickey had scouts to go out and see who he could find. And he looked at Jackie and the way he played. And Jackie was pretty good in baseball. You know, he was good at stealing bases. He was good at distracting the pitcher. But one thing that really interest him more so was that Jackie was one that was very strong will. He was one who had a lot of courage. He was outspoken. And he was just a very fierce person and educated. And so he had him to come to his office, from what I was told. And he told him what his, you know, plans were, that he was interested in signing him with the Montreal, I think it was Montreal
Royals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in Canada. And so Jackie did so well with the Montreal Canada in 1946. And he brought him back and he said, you know, Jackie, I really want to sign you on with the Brooklyn Dodgers. But he said, there's one thing. And Jackie was like, well, what is it? He said, well, if I sign you on, you know you'll be the first African-American, the first black to play in Major League Baseball, and you're going to encounter a lot of hatred, a lot of discrimination, but there's one thing you can't do. And he said, well, what is that? He said, you can't fight back. You can't retaliate. And he said, well, you mean you want me to play with the Brooklyn Dodgers, and despite how I might be treated, you don't want me to do anything? And Branch Rickey said, no. He said, understand, if you fight back, it's just going to set your people back another 10 years before they are given another chance to break the color barrier like you're going to do. And he said, it'll be probably another 10 years, because what people will say is you're not ready, even though you did nothing wrong, even though they were the people mistreating you. they would say, well, blacks are just not ready yet. So that's one thing that happened with Jackie. When he broke the color barrier, he signed him on. Jackie was isolated. Many of his teammates wouldn't speak to him. In fact, they went to Branch Rickey and told Branch Rickey that they would like to be traded to another team because they didn't want to play on a team with a black man. And Branch said, well, you can go elsewhere, but I'm not about to trade you. And he went through this for a good year or two of insults, even his wife, Rachel. And I tell people, you know, he was married. He married Rachel in 1946. And behind every great man, there is truly a great woman. Had it not been for Rachel by his side, as he went through all of those insults and discrimination and hatred and threats, death threats, and things thrown at him, he was hit several times with the ball when they would throw the ball to him to bat, and nobody did anything. When he sat in the dugout, he was sitting by himself. But one thing is that Rachel was there by his side to help him through all of this, and it was not easy. He was stressed, and as a physician, I see people dying from stress in this day and age, and I can only imagine what he went through, which was much, much more than what we're going through now. So yes, Jackie went through quite a bit. And you mentioned he was had a dishonorable discharge when he was in the military. He was in the Army for 3 years. He finished as second lieutenant. But because he refused to take a back seat in the back of the bus because he didn't want to give up his seat for a white woman. Yeah, they gave him a dishonorable discharge. But you know what? He fought it. And he took it to court. And what happened, the commanders said he was too much of an uppity you-know-what. And that's why they did what they did. But he fought that, and he won the case. And they reversed and gave him honorable discharge.
Yeah, no, this is a really interesting part of the story to me, is that on the one hand, Branch Rickey seeks him out because he is so strong and so fierce and a real fighter for himself, for his own dignity, and for that of his people. And yet at the same time, Branch senses that in Jackie there is someone who has the courage and self-control to actually not fight back when he is mistreated as he was on the ball field. And unfortunately, some of that mistreatment took place right here in Florida. Because I want to back up just a minute, because we always focus on 1947, because that's the year that Robinson breaks the color barrier in Major League Baseball as a Brooklyn Dodger. But before he ever played his first professional game in Brooklyn, he actually played in a professional integrated game right here in Florida during the spring training season of 1946 as a member of the AAA affiliate of the Dodgers, the Montreal Royals. And during that season, they're practicing. If you've seen the film 42, we're going to be showing it in a few weeks or months on Jackie Robinson Day, April 15th. If you've seen the movie, you know that he first shows up in Sanford and gets run out of town there where he's sent to practice. Later, there are opportunities for the Royals, or it's scheduled games for the Royals to play in DeLand, in Jacksonville. And all of a sudden, some curious excuses are made. Lights won't work or who knows what, and the games are canceled. Miami tells the Dodgers, don't even bother, you know, thinking about it. But one city says, yes, we will allow a team with an African-American ball player to play at an integrated game. And lo and behold, of all places, it's the city that we now associate with NASCAR, Daytona Beach. And so, Bob, I'm curious, why do you think Daytona, separate and apart from the other Florida cities that refused to let Robinson play or to put out the welcome mat for him, why Daytona? Why was it different?
Well, for one reason, Daytona was the home of a lot of snowbirds at the time, people from the north. This was before NASCAR was invented and began to draw others. And secondly, they had a very liberal newspaper called the Daytona Beach News Journal. Some of you may be familiar with it. The dean of the FAMU Journalism School, Dean Ferrier, worked for that newspaper for about 10 years. It was owned by a family named Davidson family. And unfortunately, they lost control of the paper to a chain. But they had a very liberal, pro-desegregation editorial policy there. And that may have helped create a climate that was more welcoming than other places. I wanted to add to what she said concerning the harassment. Mm-hmm. It not only was insults, but in one case, a Jackie Robinson was playing first base, and a St. Louis Cardinal named Enos Slaughter slid into him, trying to sever his one of his tendons, the Achilles tendon. And so it was actually that and the beanballs thrown at him at the plate. So it was not just verbal harassment.
All right, so we talked about 46 Robinson plays here in Florida, 47 he breaks the color barrier in Brooklyn, 1948, right here in Tallahassee, Fred Flowers is born. Yeah?
Yeah.
All right. So tell us about your early life. I'm curious to know whether you took an interest in professional baseball, whether you followed Robinson or other players, and really who first introduced you to the game of baseball?
Okay, there's so much I want to say.
How did I not know that?
I'm going to try to be responsive to your question first. Which is, I understand, how did I get interested in baseball?
How did you get interested? Who taught you the game?
Well, and Alfred Washington can attest to this. I came up in an era of the black high school where we had football teams, baseball teams, basketball teams. And so my father, we had land. We were in the heart of the city, but we had a field. And in that field, everybody in the neighborhood played ball, football, baseball. Basketball, anything with a ball, we played it. That was our major form of daycare and recreation, was playing sports. And so some people had natural ability, more so than others, and those are the ones who went on farther and farther in the process. So I was always a ball player as far as I can remember. We played ping pong. We just did it all. And so that's how I got interested in it, because that's what we did. I was a football player and a baseball player. Now, I want to – does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's great, yeah.
I want to talk to you about – you've heard some comments about Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier. And so what does that mean? There are two aspects of that. One is mathematical. You can say there were X number of white players on the team and there's one black. So he broke the color barrier in terms of mathematics. But he did something else that you may not be aware of. Jackie Robinson was never a victim. He wasn't a victim of anything. He knew who he was. The victims were the minds of the white racists. That's my view. You won't hear that in a lot of other places, but the victims were the white racists. The impact of Jackie Robinson was it caused a psychological conflict between the mind of a racist who had an idea of racial superiority, but now you see this exceptional performance of a black man. How do you reconcile that? We're still struggling with that today. So the greatest contribution of Jackie Robinson was that he made racism taboo. No longer in America, after 400 years of laws of segregation, all of a sudden, racism is immoral. Racism is taboo. So that's the greatest accomplishment of Jackie Robinson, is that he brought that, the psychological trauma, not in blacks, but in the minds of whites. And so that's where we are today, trying to reconcile this new awareness that racism is taboo with 400 years of history that says just the opposite. That's exactly where we are today. I had to say that.
And you said it really well.
Yeah.
And I really want us to pick up in just a few minutes on this theme that you introduced here about victimhood and
yes.
how it figures into this discussion,
yes.
especially about race and sports.
Yes.
Before we get there, let me pull Bob back in. And I want – we talked about Florida and its connection to Jackie Robinson and his story, the fact that Jackie comes here to play spring training ball. There's a very prominent Floridian in this story, a guy that a lot of folks here in Tallahassee remember or know or once knew, Red Barber. And so you mentioned earlier the importance of radio to American life during this time. Tell us the story of Red Barber, his connection to Jackie Robinson's story. And before you do, let me just mention as a plug, we've already run through the various sponsors for tonight's event. I would be remiss if I failed to mention that among our sponsors tonight is the Red Barber Fantasy Baseball League, which includes Rabbi Jack Romberg, our former board chair, and also includes a guy by the name of Alan Katz, whom many of you may remember. Katz not only was involved in the founding of the Red Barber Fantasy Baseball League, which I happened to get a chance to play in, but he also was a founder of the Village Square. So that's a little segue, public service announcement. Now, back to our regularly scheduled programming. Tell us about Red Barber, Bob.
Talk about the Catsburg seat or whatever. I mentioned earlier the importance of radio as of 1947. There were 40 million radios in the country and only 44,000 TV sets. In his great book about baseball, about the Dodgers, The Boys of Summer, one of the better baseball books ever written, Roger Kahn mentioned that you could walk down the streets in Brooklyn and the windows were open and you could never miss hearing the Dodgers game when the Dodgers game was on. And Red Barber was born in Mississippi, but his father was a railroad man, moved to Sanford, Florida, the town that Jackie Robinson got run out of, for a spring training game. And he grew up with some of the attitudes that were, I guess, prevalent in the time. He attended the University of Florida, where he broke into radio on the pioneering radio station there, WRUF. And later he worked for Larry McPhail in Cincinnati, and McPhail brought him to Brooklyn, and Branch Rickey kept him on as the announcer. But the thing is, not only was acceptance from the teammates an issue, but acceptance from the public also. We think of Brooklyn as a liberal enclave nowadays, but it wasn't always thus. And when listeners in Brooklyn heard this man with a southern accent just calling the games objectively, which was something he had learned in J school in Florida, it helped pave the way. And Branch Rickey not only called Jackie Robinson in before the season, but he called in Red Barber, the team's announcer, to tell him what was going to happen and ask him if he had any problem with it. And Red initially said he'd have to think about it, but later he decided to go with it. And he was a man of faith and very active in the Episcopal Church hereabouts, where Village Square meets. So he helped pave the way for Jack. So anyway, I think the importance of radio and of Red Barber was helpful in smoothing things over.
Great. Okay, so we have a connection from Jackie Robinson to Daytona and to spring training in Florida, a connection to Red Barber. He's also connected post-career to some students at Florida A&M who made history back in 1960. For those of you unfamiliar with the story, in the late 50s, there were bus boycotts here in Tallahassee, much like in Montgomery and elsewhere. And C.K. Steele and others helped to integrate Tallahassee City buses. And then in 1960, there were a number of protests surrounding segregated lunch counters. And many of the folks that were in the forefront of that movement, much like with the bus boycott, were some FAMU students. And by the way, not just FAMU students, but FAMU co-eds. It's kind of really kind of interesting here. But Patricia Stevens and her sister Priscilla and others were very prominent in leading that effort. And at one point, they were arrested, thrown in jail, and they decided that rather than posting bail, they would stage the first sit-in or jail-in of the civil rights movement, and to call attention to their cause and to get media attention. And among the people who took notice of this protest effort was Jackie Robinson. And he not only sent them letters of encouragement, but he sent all of the students journals so that they could record what was happening to them in jail to have for subsequent use. So, Linda, I'm curious to know, is this the kind of thing that was typical of Jackie Robinson after his life as a Major League Baseball player? How involved was he in civil rights activities, and what all did he do beyond just the connection to FAMU?
Jackie Robinson was a spark when it came to the civil rights movement. He and Dr. King were very close, first of all. Jackie raised the majority of a lot of the money for the civil rights movement, and not just the civil rights movement, but the NAACP. When it came to the sit-ins and the protests, he would have big concerts at his home in Connecticut, jazz concerts, people like Dizzy Gillespie, Cannonball Adderley, Ella Fitzgerald, James Brown. Many of these big artists would come to his home and perform, and that's how they raised a lot of the money they did. And after baseball, he was not only just a civil rights activist, but he was a politician and a businessman. He established the first Freedom National Bank, the first black bank in New York. He also established the Jackie Robinson Development Corporation to provide housing for the underprivileged. He was special assistant to Governor Nelson Rockefeller. And he got a lot of funding for the civil rights movement through prominent people throughout America. He was well known with President Kennedy, Eleanor Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower. Many of them participated when he won the National Baseball Hall of Fame. They had a big affair at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel in New York, and all of these people were there. Dr. King wanted to be there, but he couldn't because he was busy with the movement at that time with traveling. And it was during the time when Medgar Evers was shot and killed. Dr. King went to the funeral, but Jackie played a big part. He worked behind the scenes, and he contacted President Kennedy, and he said to him, I want you to please get the Secret Service out to Mississippi because we don't want anything happening to Dr. King. So he did a lot in the civil rights movement and helping with the protests. He came to not only Tallahassee, but I do know he came to Albany, Georgia in 61 and brought money in a suitcase. I remember, I have a picture of it at home. They gave him a parade. They were so happy to see him because, see, the parents could not protest because they had to work. So it was the students in college that were the ones who sacrificed and did what they did so that we could have more opportunities, who went to jail. But he brought that suitcase of money to bail all. It was about 400 students in jail, and he bailed every last one of them out because the sheriff had told them if they paid a certain fine, he would let them go. Well, when they paid the fine, he didn't let them go. So Dr. King got in touch with Jackie and told him what was going on. Three churches were bombed. Two in Albany, one in Sasser, Georgia, just about 20 miles away, just because they were trying to stand up for what was right. And so as a result of all those churches being bombed and destroyed, they had nowhere to go to worship. And so it was Dr. King that got in touch with Jackie, said, Jackie, would you please chair the fundraising part so these people can get their churches? And he did it. He successfully did it in 2 years. It took him 2 years to raise the money, but he did it through the very good contacts he had around the country. So Jackie was very instrumental in all of what took place with the civil rights movement. I have many pictures at home of where he was involved with Dr. King. And Dr. King has often said, you know, if it had not been for what Jackie Robinson did back in the 1940s, he would not have accomplished what he did in the 1960s. So we give tribute, we give honor to Jackie for all of the things that he's done, because he's not just a native son of Georgia. Yes, he's a native son of Georgia, but he's our American hero. He made a difference for everybody. He wanted to see everybody have an opportunity, but most importantly, his people, because he knew we deserved better. And he would do whatever he could to stand up for what was right, to fight for his people.
That's very, very well said. Thank you for that. So among other things, in addition to all of the things that Linda just mentioned in terms of his involvement with the civil rights movement, there was a time there in the late 50s and early 60s when Jackie wrote a regular column, a syndicated column, that often dealt with race issues. And lo and behold, down here in Tallahassee, Florida, another opinion writer was getting his start with the Florida Flambeau, Mr. Bob Sanchez. And tell us about the kind of state of race and sports at that time, because this is, I mean, we just talked about the 60s protests, early 60s protests, the segregated lunch counters. You told me a story about how FSU used to run out on the football field that tell us all about what was happening and some of the things that you did as a columnist.
Well, in 1961, I was fresh back from Fort Benning, Georgia, where I had served 2 years and got in trouble for suggesting that they put off limits any place that discriminated against on basis of race. This led the Georgia Senator Russell and George to ask, who is that guy down there? But anyway, because they were very powerful congressmen at that time. Anyway, in Tallahassee, the custom at the time for FSU football games, the stadium was segregated. The African-American fans, mostly people who worked for FSU in some staffing capacity, such as the laundry, were allowed to sit in bleachers on what is now the south end zone. The team was led out on the field not by Renegade, but by the Knights of Kappa Alpha fraternity waving the Confederate flag. And this is the way they, and the FSU band played Dixie at least 4 or 5 times during the games, and people were supposed to jump up and yell, I think. Some of us remained seated. And anyway, that was the nature. And also,
and you wrote a column about this protesting, well, and,
I wrote
and a, the Klan
I
show up.
I included mention of that flag waving in a column titled "Is Florida Southern?" Because in Sarasota, Florida didn't seem, the farther south you go in Florida, the less southern it is in a way. Anyway, my landlady told me that the Klan had come looking for me after that. Anyway, I'm not sure if she may have been making that up, but it did get a lot of letters to the angry letters to the editor of the Flambeau at the time. But the racial situation was very, one block from here, there was one of Tallahassee's two movie theaters was the State Theater. The other was the Florida. There was an African-American theater on Tennessee Street called the Leon Theater, and there were 3 drive-in movies, but out in the hinterlands. There was a big demonstration by FAMU students and their supporters on the streets out there. And someone broached the theater has offered to let you all in if you sit in the balcony. And the answer was, our cause is not to see movies, it's to be treated with dignity. And that is, you know, it's not to ride the bus to get somewhere, it's to be treated with dignity. And that was kind of the racial climate. The church across the street had a big schism about whether to admit African Americans. And they ran off a couple of preachers who were in favor of it, but now are very desegregated, the First Baptist Church. So that was the racial climate in 1960. Florida's state constitution had been passed in 1885 when the Jim Crow regime returned after the period of Reconstruction. And it still was under the state constitution, desegregation or racial integration was forbidden by the state constitution. Interracial marriage, desegregation of schools, and so forth. And of course, U.S. Supreme Court had overruled some of that. But Florida was very slow to follow suit. It dragged its feet as long as possible, as did other southern states regarding school desegregation.
Okay, so we're talking about schooling in Tallahassee. This is the world you're growing up in, Fred, right? You're playing ball there in your neighborhood with many of your friends. Go on to Lincoln High School, which at that time was the all black school. There was no integration yet. Lincoln wasn't yet the Lincoln that we know it of as today. And you get invited to play on an American Legion team, and in effect, before breaking the color barrier at FSU, have an opportunity to do so in youth sports here. I'm curious to know what that was like, whether you were treated well, treated poorly, whether you faced the kind of abuse that Jackie Robinson did.
Only Bill Maddox will ask a question like that. But it's a very good question and made me do some serious thinking. And I had to go back to my longtime friend Alfred Washington to get the facts straight. But when we graduated high school in 1965, during the summer, we integrated the American Legion team here in Tallahassee. There were 5 if Fred Flowers is on the mound, there are six black players. All right, so we played an all-white team from Dothan, Alabama, in Tallahassee. We played an all-white team from Tifton, Georgia, in Tallahassee. We won. We're supposed to have return trips to those cities. And so we had a meeting. The coach called us along the third base sideline, and he said he had something to tell us. And what he told us was that the parents had told him that if they were providing food and sodas for the players, their sons had to play. And so that caused a little, not a problem, a concern for the coach, because the coach said that he was a coach and he was going to play the best players. And so I think the coach resigned at that time. And so we never got a chance to play those away games against those teams. And I had to dig that up in history, thanks to your question.
And I seem to recall you telling me that there was one occasion when that you guys were instructed to meet the team at such and such location, and that's where y'all were going to be leaving from, and lo and behold, they left from a different location.
That's true. Is that right? Okay. I had to be careful. You know, I had to watch my own mind. You know, sometimes there was a fiction of my own mind. but that's a true story. Was it traumatic? Not to me. I didn't really care. I mean, I cared. But my background, my family orientation was so strong that, you know, I had a certain sense of confidence that was instilled in me from my family. So I'm looking at all this stuff going around me, and I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with them. I mean, seriously, why are they acting like this? You know, why do they think like that? I now have an understanding of why, but at that time, I really didn't understand it. I won't say I didn't care, but I was somewhat insulated by my own faith and by my own cultural background that could not be penetrated. And you can call me anything you want. Sticks and stones may break my bone. Is that the way it goes? But words will never hurt. And so, as recently as 2 months ago, I was leaving the federal courthouse, and a group of young white boys drove by, and they said, "Hey, N-word." I couldn't believe it. But then, two cars later, another group of young white boys came by and did the same thing. I had not experienced that in 40 years. But I'm completely immune to it, because the absence of intelligence is not with me.
And if you have any doubts about whether or not it's what he's saying about his family is true, you need to recognize your sister.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. First in the order of birth, I will ask my sister, Alpha Flowers Manning, would you please stand? Alpha is the one who played school teacher and taught us all how to read and write before we got to the first grade. So she taught us that, and that has carried us a long way. My third sister, I have another sister, B, who's not here, is Dobby Flowers. Would you please stand? And I led Dobby all the way through FSU to become the queen.
Yeah, no, this is, for those of you who don't know, this is a really important part of the story here. Dobby is not only one who helped integrate Leon High School and was featured in that Those Who Led the Way, but then she goes on, and after Fred breaks the color barrier as the first black athlete at FSU, lo and behold, she becomes the first homecoming queen at FSU. And the two of them are commemorated today at the on campus with the integration statue. And so we are delighted to have both of you. And when he talks about strength of character and resilience, if you're not convinced by him, just spend some time with his sisters.
No, that's true. Dobby has had an outstanding career in corporate America. I've been fortunate enough for her to be with me for the last 22 years. It's about time for a divorce.
All right. So what I want us to now do is shift gears and talk some about what we can learn from all of this and where things stand. And, Bob, I want to especially direct this to you, but really anyone can chime in as well. Why is it, do you think, that sports has been so influential in improving race relations in America, in giving opportunities for blacks to compete among whites and to kind of prove themselves? Give me a sense of why you think Jackie Robinson was such an important figure and others like him.
Maybe it's because sports is an area where merit prevails. You know, and regardless of the sport, how well you can do the sport should dictate your circumstances, and as in some other works of life. So I think that's one reason. Not that sports solves, as someone has said, sports does not build character, it reveals it. And that's another way sports has helped, because it has revealed the stupidity of racism, but also it's revealed the many biographies of people overcoming obstacles of various kind, poverty, racism, and other problems in their lives.
So if you can go and prove yourself on the field, no one cares what kind of background, whether you're a child of privilege or not, whether you're this color or that. If you can do the job, if you can score the point, if you can outperform others, you get the opportunity.
That's what Bear Bryant discovered.
Sam Bam Cunningham in 1970.
You may remember that he deliberately, we think, scheduled a game against Southern Cal, home of the Trojans.
Thank you.
And knowing they were going to get whacked. And then he kind of went to state authority saying, you know, we really need to have some of our Alabama folks on the team, regardless of race. And remember, this is a state where George Wallace has stood in the state in the schoolhouse door. So to have Bear Bryant, who was just a notch below sainthood in Alabama, I guess, until Nick Saban came along, or Nick Satan, we Miami Dolphin fans regard. Anyway, this was a breakthrough. And a lot of people who at first, now, you know, they're so religiously devoted to their football, college football teams and their alma maters, that they really have overcome some of their racial feelings.
Go ahead, please, jump in.
Okay, the question is, why does integration first happen in sports? And there's a reason for that, because I think change comes to America first through sports. Well, why is that? And here's my discernment of why that is. If you're in an arena and you see somebody playing a sport, you're a spectator. It's not threatening. It's not in your space, in your face. So white America could first appreciate the performance of blacks on the athletic fields first because it was non-threatening. It's very different from sitting next to someone in a bus, a drinker from the same water fountain, that kind of stuff. So the reason change comes first to sports is that it's less threatening. And then eventually it migrates to the mainstream society. And that's been the pattern all throughout our history. And so that's my take on.
I think there's something to this, because not only do we see this kind of spectator phenomenon in sports, we see it also in entertainment. And you could make an argument that the Dizzy Gillespies and Billie Holidays and others of the world help pave the way as well in the entertainment industry in kind of changing race relations and people's concepts of race. The thing, though, that sports has over other forms of entertainment is that it's measurable. And so, yeah, you can believe that Billie Holiday is the best singer, and I can believe someone else is, and there's really no way to settle the dispute. But when it comes to sports, you have an outcome at the end of the game. Somebody wins, somebody loses. Somebody scores more points, scores more runs, steals more bases. And it becomes clear pretty quickly, if you're looking at the kind of objective measurement of sports, who is really performing well. And in that arena, it, as Bob said, it's kind of a pure meritocracy, or close to it. You really do get a chance to see who has what it takes. And it becomes undeniable when someone is able to hold their own, as Jackie did. Jump in, Linda.
And, you know, Jackie, he truly was a catalyst. He was a pioneer of human dignity, and he was a champion for civil rights. And one of the things about him, when he played with the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, he led those Dodgers to 6 championships. And it was in 1955 that they won the World Series because of a lot of what he did. As I mentioned before, he was good at stealing the bases, and he was good at distracting the pitcher so they couldn't concentrate on what they needed to do to try to make him strike out. So he just was so talented, but he had a mind that was incredible when it came to doing what needed to be done without having to say it, so to speak. You know, and one thing I wanted to mention, when he came down to Georgia during the Civil Rights Movement, he came to Cairo. Actually, it was in the 40s. It was for spring training. He was on his way to Florida. So he stopped through Cairo, and they gave him a nice big parade, and they even took up money to give to him. And he said, "I don't want the money. I don't want, please keep your money. I don't want that money." They said, "Well, we got to give you something because we're so proud of what you've done." And he looked across the street in Cairo, and there was this old country store. And hanging in the front was this old, it was a smoked ham. And he said, "All I want is that smoked ham sitting over there." And they couldn't believe it. So they got the ham, they brought it to him, packaged it and everything. He took it back to New York to Rachel. And Rachel, being a California, she was born in California, she didn't know nothing about the smoked ham. And when he brought that ham in the house, she said, "Jack." Because she told me this story. She said, "Now, I know you're not bringing me no spoiled ham. I am not going to eat this. This is no good." He said, "No, baby, this is smoked. This is from Georgia." And she actually wanted to throw it away. So he had to call one of his neighbors who were from Georgia. And they came over and they took care of it. But she didn't want to have any part of it. But Rachel, she's told many, many stories about how things were and how it was. Sports was the favorite. Baseball was the favorite pastime in those days. And when Jackie broke that color barrier, being the only African-American playing, all he had to do was walk on the field, and the blacks who were there, they would just cheer him on, and they would just all call his name and tell him how much they loved him. And many times they would just let him know, "We got your back," because they knew what he was going through, being alone, being isolated, being called all kind of names all day long. And when they would take trips to other games out of the state, guess what? Many of them flew to where they had to go. But Jackie and Rachel, they had to catch a bus. They weren't allowed on the plane. And they took the bus. They endured all of this because they knew a better day was coming. So he was very strong. He was very courageous and quiet, in a quiet way. But he wasn't going to give up because he knew things were going to get better. But today, how far have we come now?
Say that. We're going to get there. We're going to get there in a minute, but I want to ask you a question about something that you said earlier, and that's this. In thinking about kind of the role of sports and why it is so powerful, one of the things that I really enjoyed from a favorite sportscaster, African-American sportscaster of mine, Jason Whitlock, one of the things that he says is that not only is there no crying in baseball, we all know that from A League of Their Own, but there's really very little tolerance for whining in sports. That, you know, the Saints got a time to complain about that horrible call, but I was listening to the sports talk radio today, and people were saying, "All right, get over it. You got the ball later. You won the toss for the overtime. You had a chance to win the game. Yeah, you got there was a terrible call. We all agree. But there comes a point when in sports we say, suck it up, go get it done. We don't want to hear your complaining. Everybody's got a sob story." And it reminded me that in many ways what Whitlock is saying is that there isn't a lot of tolerance for this kind of victim mentality in sports, because the ones who succeed have to overcome adversity. And you alluded to this earlier, and I want you to talk more about kind of the importance of sports in that respect.
Okay. I'm going to talk about that, but I got to address something that he said about this 1970 game between Southern Cal and University of Alabama. That was a watershed moment in American intercollegiate sports, and I think you might agree with me, because his name was Sam Bam Cunningham. He ran over the Crimson Tide for like almost 300 yards. He didn't tell you what Bear Bryant really said. In order to catch one, I got to get one. That's what he said. Could run, so in order to catch him, I got to get me some like him. And that, I'm going to suggest, is the watershed moment in American intercollegiate sports that eventually led to the downfall of HBCUs and the athletes who once went to HBCUs. Because what happened is that Bear Bryant and the other coaches, they began to raid the high schools for the black talent. And all that black talent, when I was coming up, I watched Bob Hayes play, Willie Dixon, Willie Gallimore, all the super football players. But when Sam Bam Cunningham came along, the white coaches knew what they had to do to be competitive. So one of the effects of integration, the pattern was set with the Negro Baseball League. The white league raised the black team. The black team dies. The white institution grows stronger and richer. That's exactly where we are today in intercollegiate sports. The HBCUs have gotten weaker, less talent. It's the same talent, but at a different school. There's a tremendous metaphor that describes this situation, and that is the metaphor that I alluded to later, the metaphor of the slave plantation, in which the labor is exerted by the players, but the money in intercollegiate sports that makes the cash register ring comes from the exploits of the athletes. And so there's a striking parallel in this metaphor of slavery and the explanation of today's sports. I just had to get that in when you mentioned Sam Bam Cunningham, because that truly is a watershed moment in American intercollegiate sports. And you asked me what now?
You just made a great case for paying of college players. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We should probably have a forum on that at some point, because that's a great topic that I would love to explore.
Yes.
But I want to get to Linda's question, which is this: how do we view where we are today? Should we give more emphasis to the progress that's been made, recognizing that, you know, it's been a sometimes crooked path, but should we give more emphasis to the progress that's been made or to the distance yet to go? And really, let me throw it out. Let's hear from Linda first, but I'd welcome any and all of you speaking to that question.
Well, first of all, I ask the question to you all. If you don't know where you've come from, how do you know where you're going? And yes, both of those questions that you just answered are important, to know from whence we've come in order to know how far we're going to go and where we're going to go. And I think it's important we know our history of what occurred so we don't repeat the history again. And I see that a lot even in today's society. As a physician, I'm seeing so many less African-American physicians that I did in my generation and generations before me. Our black males are declining when it comes to education. If you look at the historically black colleges and look at the ratio of male to females, the females far outnumber the males. Most of our young males are in prison, are dropped out of school. And I always mentor as many males as I can, because I want them to know about Jackie Robinson. I want them to know the story that, yes, his own father deserted the family, and he was the youngest of five, only 18 months old, when he left them in Georgia for another woman who was also married in Cairo, Georgia, and they went to Florida. Jackie never saw or heard from his father his entire life. The only time he saw his dad was when he went to the funeral. He was the only family member that went to the funeral in Florida. He just wanted to see what he looked like. But the thing that I'm saying is, I, as a physician, I've seen many kids, I've seen many young males, and I cannot believe the number of children, young people, that grew up in single-parent homes. And when you ask them about their father, well, tell me about your dad. Did he have any medical problems? I don't want to talk about him. Well, what's wrong? Well, he didn't do anything for us. He left my mom, or he was never in his life or their life. And so you wonder why these young people are doing what they do. They're hurting inside. That's the biggest part of it. They're hurting, and they don't know how to deal with it. And I tell them the story of Jackie Robinson. I said, let me tell you about Jackie Robinson. His dad left him when he was 18 months old, and four other siblings. And his mother had the sense enough to know she wasn't going to be no sharecropper no more. She wasn't going to do all that hard labor and get nothing out of it. So, yes, her brothers helped her. They made enough money to send home to bring her and her children to California, because her brother told her. He said, if you want to witness what heaven is like, come on out here to California. That's why they went to Pasadena. And they left on a 12 a.m. train. She left on a horse and buggy and left that plantation and said, we're not coming back again. But she came back to see the family, but never to see him. He didn't even know where they had gone. And all the family members act like, well, we didn't know what was going on. We didn't know they left. I don't know where they are. But everybody knew. They knew. But he was very mean to her. But the thing I'm saying is, just like Jackie went through this, it hurt the family. It hurt him to see his mother hurt. But Jackie turned that negative into a positive. He made a difference for a lot of people in America. And just like he turned that into a positive, he could have gone into a little hole and got depressed and said, my daddy don't love me. He don't even come see us. He doesn't even call us. He don't even send us nothing. And a lot of these kids are looking for these kind of things, materialistic things, and looking for love. But Jackie didn't get that. But look what he did. Look what he did because of his mom. His mom was a very Christian woman who taught them faith, not only in God, but faith in family and faith in education. And faith, yes, in America. We're going to make a difference. She was a very progressive woman who came from a progressive family. And that's why I'm proud she's my cousin.
Let me throw it open to see if there are any questions that we have from the audience. I've got more that I can ask, but we've got a gentleman here that would like to ask a question. Bob, how about lending the mic, and then you can share with Linda if you don't mind.
Wasn't there an agreement between Branch Griffey and Jackie Robinson?
Okay. I mentioned that. Yeah, that was one of the things that Branch Ricky told Jackie when they met. He said, Jack, you know, you're going to endure some difficulties, and it's not going to be easy what you're about to do. And, you know, and Jack said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, you cannot fight back. You cannot retaliate. You cannot say anything. I don't care what they do to you. And he said, what do you mean? You want a baseball player who doesn't have the guts enough to stand up and speak out and fight back? And Branch Rickey said, yes. He said, because if you do, that is going to set your people back another 10 years before they're given another opportunity to break a color barrier. And that's why he didn't.
Didn't Jack say, I'll agree to that for like 2 years or 4 seasons?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure on that part. I'm not sure. Yes, he did. Yes, he did. But those first couple of years were very important to make sure that he didn't ruin it for his people. And that's the reason why he didn't do what he did. If you look at pictures of Jackie Robinson, there's a biography that's written by Arnold Rappersed. He came down to Cairo, and I met he and Rachel and took them around where the roots were, where Jackie was born, and told them some of the stories that I was told. And if you look at the picture on that cover, or any picture of him a few years before he passed, he was only 53 when he died. Okay, 53. He played in the Brooklyn Dodgers for only 10 years, and that's because his health started failing him. He developed diabetes, high blood pressure. He had a mild stroke during the Civil Rights Movement when he was vice president of Chock Full of Nuts, which was a coffee shops all throughout New York, and they made the best donuts. But anyway, he hired all the people that worked in there were blacks. He made sure that he opened those doors for them. And he did so much, but his health was failing him. And the reason was because you all don't realize when you are stressed to the T and you can't fight back and you can't open up and voice why what these things they're doing to you, and the only person he had to go to was Rachel, it does something to your body. That's what kills people when you're under stress. And we're seeing that today. There's a high risk in suicide. There's a high risk of mental illness. I've never seen so much mental illness in my life in young people. And it's because of the stress that people are dealing with and they don't know how to cope. We're all going to have stress, but how do we cope? And he coped the best way he could. He was completely white-headed. Jackie looked like he was about 70 or 80 years old when he died. He was only 53. And the day that he died, Rachel told me they were in Connecticut at their home. She was downstairs that morning cooking breakfast. He ran down the stairs calling her name, and she went out to meet him. And he said, "Rachel, I love you." And he died. He just passed out. He had a heart attack, a major heart attack. But it was because of all of what he endured through those years from the age of 28 up until then, because he started out in baseball when he was 28, as far as the major league goes. People, stress kills. He gave his life for this country, for his people. He should have been around many, many more years. He died in 1972. 53.
All right, another question here. Oh, I'm sorry. Right here.
Just as a follow-up to the last question that Bill asked, understanding the role that Jackie Robinson played, not just on the field, but also in the streets as an activist, what do you see in the modern times and sort of the current discourse around activism in sports, and also what you all have shared earlier about the role of sports in moving the agenda, moving the needle on race relations? Do we see that in the modern times, and also how does activism play a role in that? Should activism be on the field, on the court, in the sports, or should it be on the streets? Is there a bifurcation, or is it all in one? And do we see an advancement in that relation? That's a lot.
That's a great question. By the way, Fume is one of our regular catalysts for local color. So if you come out to one of our future programs, you may get a chance to hear more from him. He's great. All right, who wants to tackle that?
I think one difference now is that athletes have a microphone of their own, in a sense. They tweet, they have their own websites, all sorts of access to the media, and therefore when they are engaged in activism, such as those who were trying to support Colin Kaepernick, the quarterback who is homeless as far as the NFL is concerned, they have avenues for their advocacy. That's the point.
If I could comment briefly.
Please.
I guess the question is, to what extent is the modern athlete politically active or something like that? All right. There are two schools of thought on that. There's one group of athletes who have the potential to exert a tremendous amount of political power, but they choose to remain silent. One is Michael Jordan. The other is Tiger Woods. They have it's their discretion to do what they want with their abilities and so forth. But in terms of activism, those two superstars choose to be apolitical. Contrast that with somebody like LeBron James and other people who are activists. So it just depends on the personality. They certainly have the money to become very influential persons, but they don't have the psychological freedom and the monetary freedom to do so. They are not organized. Can you imagine the power of the athletes if they had the audacity to organize? So even if you look at college campuses, the athletes, and it didn't used to be that way, but the athletes tend not to be involved, and there's a reason for that. They have the rigors of the athletic games to participate in, but they're also under strict control of the culture, the coaches, through the scholarship system. So back in my day, the athletes were very active politically. At FSU, there was John Burt, who was the, well, I was the second BSU president. There was John Burt, who was a great basketball player. And he was a BSU president. That has changed somewhat today. I just think that it's a matter of what you think is important. Contemporary athletes have the money to do whatever they want to do. They just don't have the insight to realize their own potential. But that's my take on it.
Doctor, as a family member, I'd love to hear your reflection. I'm sorry I was late. If you covered this, you can just excuse my question. But I'd like your reflections on the movie 42, how the family felt about that. Hollywood always takes liberties with everything that they do. But I obviously, it was a great movie, but did they take a lot of liberties? Did they get enough of the true Jackie into that? Certainly, his demeanor that I remember as a child and lived through reflected the kind of person that you talked about. His value system was the type of person who didn't seem to me to need to scream and yell and be at the front of protest. I didn't know of his activism like that, but I certainly saw him as an immense figure in my life in breaking barriers down in a incredible way. But your thoughts about the movie?
Yeah, the family was, they thought it was a very good movie. They thought it reflected a lot of what he went through and how he reacted primarily. But the thing is that there's so much more to it, to the story, that wasn't so much revealed. Rachel doesn't like to talk about the negative. She focuses only on the positive, because the negative is not going to make a difference now. It happened. And I tell her, well, we need to know the story. We need to know what he went through, because hopefully that will touch somebody else's soul to say, I went through something similar to that. And I didn't react the way he did, but I need to think about it and maybe make a change. You know, Jackie, he motivated so many people to be better than what they were. And that's what I love so much about him, because he helped make me a better person. And when people told me I couldn't do something, oh, don't ever tell me that. Because that's what I'm going to show you, I'm going to do it.
Yes, sir. Good afternoon. Good evening. I appreciate you all having this forum today. And I would really say that I'm actually surprised when I saw the advertisement for tonight's event, how diverse our crowd is, I'll put it that way. And hearing the stories of Jackie Robinson and, of course, Fred Flowers being a local hero of sorts over at Florida State. They say that Sunday is one of the most segregated hours in America. I think, take the religion part off and talk about sports. On Saturday afternoons from 12 to 3, 3 to 6, or 8 to 11, when you're looking at those games, what I hope that we are learning here today is that when we get a chance to cheer for someone who doesn't look like us, and it gives us a chance to brag and boast about our institutions of higher learning sometimes, what are we doing once we leave those particular venues to try to still get to know each other? And that's always just been, I worked a lot of years at Florida A&M University, and of course I attend games across the street as well. But I just hope that as we hear these stories, we just start realizing that, you know, when we can cheer and cheer and cheer for 3 hours for a kid, but if that same kid or his cousin was on a corner going down Monroe Street or Tennessee Street, would we still communicate with them? And so I think to your point about sports, and I wanted my son to come and hear about the legendary Jackie Robinson, so I'm glad he's here, and he's a baseball guy over at Capitol Park. But I just think that as we are in rooms like this and we're talking about this and think about sports brings us together for a moment, but when we leave those confines of those venues, if we're still not being connected, trying to be connected, it's really kind of failing us. And so, to Fred's point, the institutions are not just making a lot of money. The prestige of institutions are going. I'm not saying these institutions don't have great college professors and staff and et cetera, but I'm talking about the prestige of institutions are going through the roof because of what happens on a Saturday afternoon. And I just think that if we can start appreciating that difference, but hearing some of those stories, it'll allow us to become better. So I'm just curious kind of what you think about that, but that's my take on it. I thank you so much for being here this evening, ma'am, and Fred for sharing your story, and hopefully forums like this would allow cities like Tallahassee, which I consider to be one of the best in America, are from Chicago, but I've been in 30 years, and I think it's one of the best cities in America, and forums like this allow us to become better people.
I want to just mention something when he was saying that. You know, Jackie Robinson was always quoted, life is not important except for the impact it has on other lives. And in saying that, he was saying to us that we must get out there and do our part, not wait on somebody else. We can make a difference. And as our great President Obama, Barack Obama, has often said, if you want to see change, you are the change that you want to see. And I thought about that. I said, you know, that's what I've been doing all this time. And I didn't realize that's exactly what it is. All the years that when I came back to Cairo, Georgia in 96, there were no black physicians. There were no female physicians. I was the first black or white. And it was not easy. I was not all that welcomed. But I didn't care about that because that was my family roots in that area out in the country, in the sticks of Georgia, which I was very proud of. And I came back for that reason. And a lot of people tried to discourage me, but I didn't give up. I was going to do whatever I had to do, even though I didn't make a lot of money. I'm still paying off student loans now, but I'm doing what makes me happy. And, you know, so it's up to us. Whatever you see that's going on in life that does not please you or is not going the way you would like it to be, instead of complaining, get your butt out there and do something. Help somebody else. And I think about when I was in Sebring, Florida, going to school, and I would be walking home with my classmates, and there would be alcoholics sitting out there on the street, you know, by the candy stores where we would stop. And I did not disrespect them at all, because you know what? They would always tell us, all right, you kids, you better get your education. Be the best you can be. Even though they didn't have it, but I respected them because I appreciated that. And I can still hear those voices echoing in my head now. Whenever I wanted to get discouraged when I was in medical school and I thought I couldn't do it, I think about what they would say and what my family would always say. Don't let nothing stop you from your dreams. And you have to instill that into others, into your child and other people. And look at these boys walking out there in the streets with their pants hanging down. And, you know, talk to them, men. They need you, not the mamas. They need the men to get out there and start talking and mentoring these kids. And we need more of that to go on. And that's what I try to do. You know, as mentor our young people, let them know I didn't get where I am by myself. There were many people in my life that made it happen for me. And I don't forget those people. And just like they helped me, I reach back and help somebody else. And if we did enough of that in this country, we wouldn't have the mess we got going on today.
All right, so we've got time for one more. Please, yes. She's awesome. Okay, we've got time for one more question from the audience. I'm then going to give each of you a chance to give us maybe 30 seconds on what we can most learn, you think, from Jackie Robinson. And then we have a really, really special treat for you. But first, audience question right here.
Thank you, panelists, for a great discussion this evening. I've always wondered if it hadn't been for Jackie Robinson and his impact, could we have a Martin Luther King just a few years later?
Did I not say that earlier? I said that very same thing. I told them that Dr. King, I didn't know Dr. King. I knew his father, Daddy King. We called him Daddy King because he would always come to my uncle's church in Detroit and preach, and I got to know him that way. And one of the things he often told me about Jackie was that his son would often say, had it not been for Jackie Robinson and what he did and all of what he went through, there would never have been a Dr. Martin Luther King to do what he did. So he always gave tribute to Jackie for what he did so that he could do what he did. And so, yes, had it not been for Jackie Robinson, there would not probably have been a Dr. King to do what he did, okay, in the civil rights movement and moving our country forward.
Very good. Very good. All right. 30 seconds each. What lessons can we learn from Jackie Robinson to take away from tonight? 30 seconds.
Well, I don't mind starting because I can talk about him all night long. But I'm just going to say in 30 seconds, first of all, Jackie Robinson, if I took away anything, that he was a man that knew who he was and whose he was. He never forgot God. He never forgot from where he came from, the sticks of Georgia, because that was always on his mind, to do something to make things better in the South for all people. So having that great faith and that belief in God that was instilled with him through his mother is what made him the great man he is, and that is a lesson that I have never forgotten, that with God, anything is possible.
Very good. Jump in, Fred.
Bill, your 30-second rule. Just before I talk about what I think are the lessons that we learned from Jackie Robinson, I would like to ask you a question. How many of you have ever heard the name of Moses Fleetwood Walker? Yeah. So you know that Jackie Robinson was not the first black man to play Major League Baseball. The first African-American to play Major League Baseball was Moses Fleetwood Walker in the year 1884. So it took another 67 years before Jackie Robinson came along to break that barrier. So I just want to give some play to Moses Fleetwood Walker. All right. What are the lessons that we learned from Jackie Robinson? And I think Professor Terry Coonan is going to recognize where some of this comes from. One thing that Jackie Robinson, one lesson he taught us is the power of one. One person can change the world. One person can take a match and set a whole forest on fire. One person, Martin Luther King, Nelson Mandela, Jackie Robinson, can change the world. Then another lesson he teaches us is the power of now. Jump in right now, make a difference right now, rather than succumbing to your own fears. Another lesson is the power of many, which is broader, and it suggests cooperation and cooperation among us all to eventually get to the mountaintop that Martin Luther King talked about. And what I'm going to say to you next, you might find a little shocking, because I'm going to quote the words of the president of Florida State University, John Thrasher. He was asked he was commenting on the subject of rights to all people, no matter what race or sex. And this is what President John Thrasher said. He said that based on his many experiences as the president, coming in contact with all different people and races, that he had become a changed man. And that what he had learned were three things: respect, civility, and Lord knows we need more civility in our political discourse. But the other thing President Thrasher said, that we need acceptance. Now that's very insightful. He didn't say we need more tolerance, because if I say I'm going to tolerate you, that means I think I'm better than you. I'm just going to let you do your thing, and I'm going to tolerate it. But he had the insight to speak of the need for acceptance. And so those three core values, respect, civility, and what was it?
Acceptance
are the core values that we can take with us from the life and legacy of Jackie Robinson.
Very nice.
You want to jump in, Bob?
Yeah, I can't top that. I'd just say this. The era in which we live will be chronicled at some point in the future, just as the period when Jackie Robinson was broke the color line was being chronicled. And the people that resisted were written about. The people who were heroic, like Pee Wee Reese, eventually embraced him during a game. He was a Kentuckian, too. The important thing is to kind of be on the right side of history. Sometimes you may be the only one, the power of one. Sometimes you may be inspiring the many.
Very nice. All right, so I mentioned that we've got a film coming up on April 15th. Starting tomorrow until the 15th of April, we have a special treat, especially for the young, like your son, but for the young at heart as well. And that is, we're doing something called the 42 Challenge. And you can find out more information on this at our website, Facebook. Leslie can also direct you tonight if you're interested. What you will do is, it's like a scavenger hunt, fun historical scavenger hunt, where you will visit four different local sites that are connected to Jackie Robinson and his story, including a site that we referenced earlier tonight that involves Fred. So go look that up. Have a chance to complete the circuit, circle the bases. It'll qualify you for prizes that we'll draw on the night of our film showing, which will include things like replica jerseys and bobbleheads and baseball card of Jackie Robinson. So this is a great way to acquaint your kids and others that you know with the local history and how it's connected to Jackie Robinson. So much like Jackie, strive to be the first in your group to complete the circuit, okay? Be the first from FAMU, the first from FSU, the first under the age of 42, the first over the age of 42, okay? The first local businessman, the first politician. We want to see all of you circle the bases, learn about local history, honor Jackie Robinson with us during this special year. So that's the first thing. We've got a cake that you'll want to be sure to get a slice of before you leave tonight to celebrate his birth. But now we've got a real special treat for you. We've told you that Dr. Walden is a medical doctor, but here's something that we didn't mention. She's also a very outstanding gospel singer, and she's going to close out our program tonight with a song that was one of three sung at the funeral for Jackie Robinson back in 1972. And so I'm going to turn it over to her. I think the three of us probably ought to just clear the stage.
No. Before I sing, I just want to say one last thing. Of course, Rachel, his wife, is still living. She's 96 years old. She started the Jackie Robinson Foundation the year after he died in 1973, which still is doing very well. They have the Jackie Robinson Scholars Program, where they give $30,000 to a rising senior that's going to go to accredited four-year college. Of course, you have to apply online. They've given over $83 million in scholarships since 1973. And just so that you know, since this is the 100th birthday for Jackie Robinson, the Jackie Robinson Museum is under construction. They've already raised $28 million out of $43 million that they need to raise. The foundation plans to open the Jackie Robinson Museum in December of 2019. So starting today, starting in New York, there will be an exhibit traveling tour of much of Jackie's memorabilia traveling around the country in various states. However, those states that are already on the map, and plus the Essence Festival is going to be one of them, New York, Philadelphia, California, but we want to get Florida and Georgia. So I'll be contacting my governor and several other people, prominent people in Georgia, because we want them. You have to be a sponsor in order for them to come. And the sponsorship is about $50,000, because the money goes for the museum, because as I mentioned before, they have about 22, something like that, million dollars to raise so that they can open this beautiful museum So I have some pamphlets. I don't know. Liz, where's Liz at? Okay, at the front table. So pick a plan up. Pick up one of them and be sure to send a contribution. However small, it doesn't matter, as long as you send something that helps with the coming of this museum, which we want to see happen. This will continue the legacy of Jackie Robinson. It's going to be in New York City, where the Jackie Robinson Foundation is, but it's going to be a huge, huge museum. It's going to have a lot of memorabilia. The curator has called and talked with me about a lot of things down here in Georgia. You know, and as I mentioned, there were many things that I did to try to bring honor to Jackie, because nothing had ever been done to honor him until I came back here in 96, and that was the 50th anniversary in 97. I had the highway renamed, signs put up downtown stating the birthplace of Jackie Robinson, put a state historical marker with the help of U.S. Senator Max Cleland, wrote the script for that. And I'm just saying this to say it doesn't take an army to do things. One person can make a difference. And so when these ideas and visions came to me, I still want to build a multicultural center, an amphitheater. I want to have a baseball field to bring spring training. What better place to come for spring training for Major League Baseball than Cairo, Georgia? I'm serious. Okay? So these are the visions that I had when I came, but a lot of people didn't see it. I wanted to put a statue downtown in Cairo, Georgia to bring tourism here. These people don't realize when you honor somebody like Jackie, do you know what that does for your community? They don't see it. And I wanted to have this statue. I even had Sandy Proctor, you all may know, who's a sculptor here in Tallahassee. He did the statue would look like in cardboard. He brought it in to the county commissioners at the courthouse. That was the largest turnout they ever had at the courthouse when I went before them to try to get this done. Well, they never told me no, but they never said yes either. But unfortunately, as a result of my wanting a statue there, which nobody ever wanted anything on the courthouse lawn, they ended up a couple of months later putting a Confederate memorial. So I'm just saying this. That doesn't destroy what I want to do. I'm going to still pursue it when the time is right. It's just not right yet. But God will make a way, because if there's a will, there is a way.
All right, so gentlemen, clear the stage, and we're going to let Linda close us out with a great song. And let me just mention, Linda's family associated with the Jack Hadley Museum in Thomasville is responsible for a lot of the memorabilia that you see around. And if you are a local businessman and would like to sponsor our 42 Challenge, see me before you leave tonight, because there's a great opportunity for you to do that.
And also I want Mr. DeMarcus Underwood. He is the educational director at the Jackie Robinson Museum, who bought some of this memorabilia. Please stand so they can see you. He lives here in Tallahassee, but he works at the Jackie Robinson Museum.
Yes. Oh, April, yeah. Okay, cue the music and away we go. Okay. And if you want to sign up for the challenge tonight, see Leslie.
This is one of Jackie Robinson's favorite songs, If I Can Help Somebody. As I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a song, if I can show somebody he's traveling wrong, then my living will not be in vain. This is from my CD, my very first CD that I recorded, believe it or not. This is just my performance track. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or a song, if I can show somebody he is traveling wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a Christian, all this way, my lady. Joy, happiness, peace, and love. Help somebody. You oughta help somebody. Help somebody as you pass along. My living shall not be in vain. My living shall not be in vain. Thank you.